شاء الله ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين خاتم النبيين شفيع المذنبين رحمة للعالمين مولانا وسيدنا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين المظلومين الهداة المهديين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرض أرواحنا له الفداء ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال أمير المؤمنين إمام المتقين مولى الموحدين علي بن أبي طالب والله لو أعطيت الأقاليم السبعة أقاليم السبع بما تحت أطلافها على أن أعطي الله في نملة أسلبها جذب شعيرة ما فعلته فالمحمد وآل محمد صلوات Respected elders, brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yesterday we had discussed the issue of friendship, relationship. We discussed how to choose a friend, what should be the criteria. Then we discussed regarding a framework of how we can deal with people's expectations of us, whom we should please, how we should please them. Today's discussion, before I go into today's discussion, I have an interesting question which someone posed, and I was very happy to receive this question because it shows that there is a good degree of knowledge among some of our community members. He said, for example, the verse which I quoted, قُلْ اِعْمَلُوا فَسَيَرَ اللَّهُ عَمَلَكُمْ. Do your actions, Allah sees your actions, and the Prophet sees your actions, and the mu'mineen see your actions. He said, well, the tafsir isn't mu'mineen, Ahlul Bayt. So I was very pleased to receive that question. It shows that people are listening, thinking, and they have a good basis of knowledge. So absolutely it is true. It appears that verse does refer to Ahlul Bayt in its deeper sense. But what you have to bear in mind is that the Quran has a Zahir and a Batin. And these two things cannot contradict. So the Zahir is Mu'mineen. And some scholars have interpreted it as Mu'mineen. And of course the deeper tafsir is Ahlul Bayt. Because even when they leave this world, they still have a view on the world, like we described in Balkan. They still have a view on the world, and they know what is happening. So, both ways, the tafsir is valid. However, even if we don't use that verse for mu'mineen, we still have enough evidence out there that the opinions of mu'mineen matter. For example, that's one of the biggest proofs. Amr bil ma'ruf Nahi Anil Munkar is based on what? Sometimes it's based on the view of the mu'min. Something doesn't seem right according to his interpretation of religion that has some bearing. So, this was a very good question and I appreciated that. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. What if we don't care? What if we say, I am what I am, take me or leave me, take me as I am, take it or leave it? What if we adopt that attitude? We'll become a society and a community which is very careless of people's views and opinions. We may end up offending every other person. We may end up being very unpopular. If we do it as a community, let's say we do it as a community, we say, to hell with everybody else, we'll do what we want. then we'll end up being a very lonely community. People will view it very negatively. So, within the hierarchy that I described, we should be concerned about, first and foremost, Allah, secondly, Ahlul Bayt, thirdly, Mu'mineen, fourthly, wider society. We want to salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, tonight's discussion is very special and very fundamental. It's a discussion which spans the whole of our religion. It is a discussion based on community, society, family, and individual. I want to start with something from Nahjul Balagha. Then I want to describe the concept of justice. And then I want to return to the same Nahjul Balagha incident. And inshallah, we'll bring it together in a nice way. Then we'll look at justice in religion. And then we'll look at justice in ethics. Justice is a very wide and broad concept. During the time of the first Imam, Amirul Mu'mineen, alayhi salatu wa salam, was asked a question. This is at saying number 437 of Nahjul Balagha. If you want to refer, saying number 437. Su'ila alayhi salam, he was asked, Ayyuma afdal, which is better, Al-Adl awil Jood, is justice better or is generosity better? The question asked of the first Imam was, which of these is better, justice or generosity? I'm not going to tell you the answer now. I'm going to explain some concepts and then we'll return to the question. But you can think in your mind. First of all, let me start off with a broad concept of justice in Islam. When we say justice in English, typically what do we mean? We mean things like courts, judges, cases, verdicts. We think of people being brought to justice. They've done something wrong. Justice must be done on them. They are brought, a case is presented, there are arguments to and fro, finally the judge or the jury, bearing everything in mind, issues a verdict, we say justice has been done. Or justice has not been done, one or the other. In Islam, adl or adalat has a much wider scope than this. Actually, in Islam, adalat can apply to a person even if he or she is alone in a desert with no one around them, with no government, no court, no police, no crime, no system, nothing, justice can still apply to that person. What do I mean? For example, a person who has talents and wastes those talents has done injustice. A person who has time and frivolously loses the time or wastes the time has done injustice. A person who disobeys God, goes outside of the boundaries set by God. God has said this is a law. He breaks that law. He has done injustice. Justice is adl or adalat. Injustice is zulm. What do we say in Dua-e Kumail? Zalamtu nafsi. When we say to Allah, we have done something wrong, we say, I have done injustice to myself. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allah said, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَتِلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ. These are the boundaries of Allah. وَمَنْ يَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَ اللَّهِ فَقَدْ ظَلَمَ نَفْسَهُ. Whoever crosses the boundaries of God has surely done zulm on himself. So, that is one aspect of Islamic justice. That justice starts from within. It can apply to the self, and it does apply to the self first and foremost. Now, what about zulm or injustice done to another person? This is very interesting. Ulama of Islam, the scholars of religion, say that when a person even thinks about doing zulm to another person, even he has the intention that I'm going to do zulm to another person, he has actually started by doing zulm on himself. The registration in the divine record is that this person, even with the intention that I'm going to do zulm on someone else, has started with zulm on himself. Anything you do bad to someone else, you have started with yourself. Before you reach zulm to another person, zulm has been enacted upon you by your own self. There's a beautiful hadith which says, أَكْرِمْ نَفْسَكَ عَنْ كُلِّ دَنِيَّةٍ. Raise the level of your soul so that you don't fall into any misdeeds, any crimes against Allah. You raise yourself, you make it honorable, you make it noble. So anything we do to another person, we have started with ourselves. With one more salawat ala Muhammad. Now, we come on to the next stage. Justice starts from within, with an individual, with yourself. The next stage is to those around you. And typically those around us are our family members. Very often what happens, and this is very sad, it's a very sad reflection of society, we often turn a blind eye to the zulm happening in the home. We have issues amongst in-laws, mother-in-laws, daughter-in-laws. We turn a blind eye. We have issues amongst husband and wife. We turn a blind eye. We say, that's their private matter. Parents do zulm on their children. We turn a blind eye. We say, we don't want to get involved. This is a matter of that household. We don't want to get involved. For sure, we should not be spying and prying into anyone's life. But if there is a case of zulm happening, then an honorable person will not see that happening. He will try to remedy the situation. So it seems many times in our culture and sometimes in our communities, we can be very nice and squeaky clean outside the home. In our offices, there's no farishta like us. In our street, on the street, going, coming, there's no angel like us. But in the home, it's a different matter. This is also zulm, and it should not be happening. So self and people around us. Islam says, not allowed. Zulm under any situation is not allowed. Now, what about where Islam takes it even further? Islam in its ethics is very sophisticated. Think about this with one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Islam says that as far as zulm is concerned, even your open enemy cannot be treated with zulm. Zulm is injustice, isn't it? Injustice is not excusable in any form. Even your open enemy cannot be treated unjustly. So if there's a punishment to give to someone who has done something wrong, you give the punishment by all means. But you don't go over that level. So for example, after Mawla was struck in Masjid al-Kufa, what does he say when they bring Ibn Muslim in front of him? What does he say? He says, remember one thing. He struck me once, You are to strike him once, not more than once. Even if he doesn't kill him, you can't strike him again. Why? Zulm is not allowed. It is stroke for stroke. Quran says, Ya ayyuha allatheena amanu, O you who believe, the verse says, La yajrimannakum shana'anu qawmin, do not let the hatred of a people take you away from justice, and that you do injustice to a person or a people that you don't necessarily agree with, or they are your enemy, or there is some hatred between you, or there is some conflict. You can go to the extent of justice, but you cannot go above justice into zulm. Zulm, under any situation, is not allowed. Or you who believe, Quran says, be maintainers of justice. An ill feeling for a people should never lead you to be unfair. What happens to us is the moment we feel a conflict with a person, we will not speak to them for God knows how long. We will do all manner of things to them. We will treat each other like the dirt under our feet. All of a sudden the conflict is restored, the conflict is solved, and we become buddies again. It should not happen like that. Principles are principles, but it doesn't mean we sacrifice relationships. Doesn't mean that we do zulm and go over the limits of adalat. Now we come on to the next level. So what have we dealt with so far? Self, family, enemy. Now one step further. We want salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Islam says that adalat is so fundamental. There is a hadith that so-and-so lady will enter hell because of the cat she imprisoned in the house who starved to death. Islam says zulm on animals is not allowed. People, we could have imagined, isn't it? Islam says zulm on animals is not allowed. You treat an animal unjustly, it's not allowed. Islam says that's a sin. Now we come on to another one. Even further. Insect. Is zulm allowed on an insect? Insect bugger, we don't like them. We feel sometimes even scared of them. Are we allowed to kill them? Are we allowed to do zulm on an insect? Mawla puts it very nice. Let me tell you what he says. In Nahju Balagha, once again with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Please listen to each and every word of this. Okay? It's like golden. Mawla says, Wallah, by Allah, even if I am given the kingdom of the seven continents with all that exists under the sky, that I may disobey Allah to the extent of snatching one grain of barley from an ant, I would not do it. Give me the whole world. The whole dunya is mine. All I need to do is a small insignificant ant, and I take a grain of food from it, a barley grain from an ant. All I said, I would not do it. The world is not worth enough that I disobey my Lord and I do zulm to an insect. Islam says that where insects are concerned, if an insect, or any animal for that matter, is posing a threat to you, is a danger to you, is bringing in dirt, is spreading disease, is somehow harassing opposing a brother, then you have a justification to do something to that insect or animal in a just manner. It could be that you have to kill it. It could be that you just have to make it go away some other way. But you don't cross the bounds and kill things for no reason. You are outside. There's an insect doing nothing at all to you. For whatever reason, it's not bothering you in any way, it's living its life, you kill it. Islam says not justified. It is not justified. So Islam even goes to this extent. Now, they say regarding the late Imam Khomeini, that when he was in Najaf, his level of taqwa was exceptional, of course, we know this. It is shown in Najaf, they say, that when he was in Najaf studying, and there would be flies and mosquitoes in his room, he would not kill them. He would put them out somehow, using other things, but he would not kill them. That was his level of taqwa. He didn't want to go to that stage where he had to kill these things. Some people are at that level. So, we have other fatwas, for example, our ulama in general, well, I have not seen a fatwa against it. In general, what they say is that if you go hunting purely for sport, purely to kill the animal, you have no intention of eating the meat, they say this is haram. To derive pleasure over just the killing of another being without using that meat, you have no intention of eating it, nothing, you just want to kill something. Well, the man says that when you go, for example, if you're a traveler, you need to pray full. You can't pray custom, because that's a sinful journey. This is the extent Islam has emphasized justice, adalat, and has strictly forbade zul. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Now we come back to the question. Imam was asked, Ayyuma afdal al-adlu aw al-jood? Which is better? Is justice better or generosity is better? Imam says, Al-adl. Justice is better. Why? Surely generosity is better. What is justice? Justice is simply putting things in their right place. But generosity is over and above that. Generosity is that I'm not expected to be generous, but I give extra. You get off the rickshaw, you get off the taxi, you tip the driver, he's not expecting it, he's happy. If you pay him just what's on the meter, okay, fine. You've done your bit, you paid me what you owe me. Give him 10, 20 extra, he's happy. He's surprised. He's not expecting it. So isn't generosity better? Mawla says no. Now the way we explain this is as follows. For example, generosity is required where? Generosity is required in a society in which there is disparity. When there is a lack of fairness in society, you need generosity. So you have to go to people and say, can you be generous? Can you pay some money so we can give the money to the poor? Islam says, it's better that there are no poor. If there was justice, there would be no poor. If everyone had equality, if everyone had equal opportunities, then we would not need necessarily these extra steps. Of course, generosity is brilliant. Don't get me wrong. To be generous is wonderful. But it is a particular reliever. Mawla says justice is a constant state that should be there. This is the view of such a godly man. He says justice must be there at all stages in society with one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So, is very fundamental. The ulama say that the most fundamental value in ethics is justice. Why? Because justice can never be wrong. Can you think of any instance that justice can be wrong? You can say that in this situation, mercy would be better, but you cannot say justice is wrong. A child does something, there is a set punishment, for example. To punish him would not be wrong, you may choose to go towards mercy. A repeat offender, someone who commits crime after crime after crime and doesn't improve or gets worse, by mercy, should we give him more mercy to make him go even worse the next time? So mercy can be wrong. Truth. Someone will say truth can never be wrong. Let's say we are holding a secret. Let's say our first imam comes and he gives us a secret. And a gun is put to our head and it says, tell me the secret of your imam. If we are truthful, we will say it. Truth in that situation would be wrong. So, justice can never be wrong. So the ulama say, the most fundamental value on which we build everything else, which needs to be there at the fundamental point, is justice. Now we move on with one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. When our beloved first imam becomes Khalifa, as you know, during the time of Uthman, Uthman had a very corrupt habit. One of his best habits when he was in power was he would give unfair due to his family. He would give them extra resources, extra money, extra land, extra posts. He would give it all to his family members. So what happened was, all of a sudden, lots of misappropriation of funds was happening. Lots of injustice was taking place. People were not receiving their due from the public treasury. When Mawla comes to power, some people said to Mawla, they said, don't worry about what happened before, start now. Forget what happened in the past, it's too messy. We cannot clean up that mess. Start now. Mawla says, if you want me as your ruler, I will even take back the money that was used illegally in marriages of women. I will even take that back. Are you ready for that? Mawla says, I will not stand for any money, any corruption, any misappropriation of funds. You really want me as your leader? And of course, the people, at that time they said yes. But then through his khilafah, there was so much unrest because people couldn't take that justice of Imam Ali. That justice was not meeting their own selfish expectations. Now how does a man come to that kind of level? When he has that regard for justice. Again, we come to our value. And I keep coming back to the same value. And it comes again and again. When a person has less love of the world, his justice will increase. He won't mind the battles he has to face, the fights he has to do to establish justice. Mawla is such an individual. When he describes the world, I don't think you'll find anywhere else the descriptions of the world as Mawla gives us. He gives us some very ajeeb descriptions of the world. And only he can put it in this way. Let me give you three examples in the Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. In Khutbah number 3 of Nahj al-Balagha, he describes why he took the post of Khalifa. Said it was for a number of reasons. He said the people were so insistent. Number 2, there were so many supporters. When there is a support, an imam has to agree. Because that's why Imam Hussain agreed to go to Kufa, because of the letters coming in. People say, why did Imam have to leave? Of course he had to leave. He had to answer the request. He said, if it was not for all of these reasons, do not think that Ali took the Khilafat. Let's have one salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali. He says, if it's not for all of these reasons, then do not think for a moment that Ali took the Khilafat for any worldly gain. وَلَا أَلْفَيْتُمْ دُنْيَاكُمْ هَذِهِ أَزْهَدُ عِنْدِي مِنْ أَمْسَكِ عَنْدِ. Anyone other than Mawla could not have said this sentence. He says, otherwise you would have seen that this world of yours is less valuable to me than the sneeze of a goat. In some places he says, this world is worth less than this shoe which I have prepared so many times. In some places he says, this world is like the food stuck in the teeth after a meal. Who other than Mawla has said this? Amazing sentences that give you the perspective of the world according to this great man. Now we move on to the next level of instruction. So adalat is very fundamental. It's very necessary. It's very much part of our thinking. It's very much part of our religion. Second level of discussion is adalat in fiqh, in Islamic law. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. The quality of adalat is required in a number of Islamic roles. For example, Besh Imam, the person who leads Namaz-e-Jamaat, must be adil. For example, Marja-e-Taqleed must be adil. Just. For example, witnesses who come and testify in a case must be adil. For example, moon sighting issues. We always say the moon is established if two adil people come and tell you. Adil. Again and again, in Islamic law, we see the mention of the importance of adalat. What is adalat? Is adalat trustworthiness? For example, when you go to your doctor, what do you look for in a doctor? You go to your doctor, you want someone who knows what he's talking about. You want someone who's graduated from a decent university. You want someone who knows about your ailment that can communicate with you. Do you care what your doctor does in his spare time? You hire a lawyer, you want a lawyer who is a good advocate, who can fight your case, who can deal with documentation, who can present you nicely in front of the judge. Do you care what he does in his spare time? In these kinds of professions, we don't care. We are least bothered about what these people do in their spare time. Islam says no. When it comes to Islamic positions of responsibility, Islam says you must care. Because in Islam, the viewpoint is you cannot separate the person from their trustworthiness in and out of the position which they have. So if there's a marja, if there's a Besh Imam, you cannot say, well, as long as he leads namaz nicely, or as long as he gives fatwa nicely, he's fine. What he does in his spare time, who cares? No. Islam doesn't say this. Islam says you must be bothered. This is why I salute and I deeply respect our ulama and our maraji. May Allah keep them with us. May He keep their shadow on us. May He give them long lives. Our maraji are gold. Look at the way they live. Look at their humbleness. Look at their zuhur. Look at their taqwa. Look at how firm they are in religious matters. Why is it so important? Why can't we just say, it's okay. At the time of giving fatwa, he should be pious, otherwise it's fine. No, what we say is this. We say, there are two things. Number one, spiritual character. In Islam, we want to see individuals who are leaders, who have spiritual character, who have taqwa, who have khawf-e-khuda, fear of God. Why? Let me give you an example with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The amount of times this has happened to me, brothers and sisters, someone writes me a question, for example, he says, can you ask Ala Kisani this question or any other Ayatollah? First of all, I don't know why people want me to ask the question. It's the same result whether I ask or they ask. I don't have any influence over the answer, nor does he know me personally, nor is my email address so famous. But anyway, can you ask this address, can you ask this question to Ala? Fine. Send the question, reply comes back. I forward it back to brother. Brother says, I think Allah has not understood my question. Can you ask it again? Same question again. Okay, fine, let's play it again. Same question again. Presto, same answer again. What were you expecting? The amount of times people have said, this marja, na'udhubillah, I don't want to say this, brothers and sisters, but because it's fundamental, I have to say these words. The amount of times people have said, this marja doesn't understand our situation. Give me a break. Honestly. Marja doesn't understand the situation. We have proof of that, do we? After everything we've heard in ethics about how to treat another woman, we have proof of that, that a marja doesn't understand the situation. The amount of times people have said, don't worry, when I go to Najaf, I'll convince him to change his mind. What does that mean? That means I don't want a marja telling me what the law of God is, I want a marja telling me what I want to hear. So, what we say is that adalat is so important. Why? Because he has shown throughout his life that he has got impeccable conduct. So tomorrow, if someone turns up to his office in Najaf and says, here's $1 billion, can you change this fatwa? He will say, sorry, it doesn't work like that. He can't be bought. He can't be threatened. He can't be treated in that way. That is why we want our leaders, maraji, to be so high in adalat. They cannot be influenced in this way. They are the representatives of imams. They represent our religion. And we have the guts sometimes to criticize them. By all means, there are improvements to be made in every system. In every system there will be improvement. But to cast doubt upon a person's integrity without proof, it doesn't match Islamic ethics. So, we need Besh Imam to be adil. We need marjas to be adil. So these are scholars. What about people? What about you and me, lay people, students of religion, humble mourners of Imam Hussein? If you want to testify, we need to be adil. You want to tell someone you sighted the moon, you need to be adil. It's not just scholars and maulanas that have to be adil. Remove that thought from your mind. Everyone is expected to be adil. What would you feel if someone said, I'm sorry, I cannot take your testimony because you're not adil? What a slight it would be on us. We are all expected to be adil and have adalat in our lives. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. When we think of adalat, it's not just his role, it's what he does in his spare time, it is the way he interacts with his children, it is the way he treats his wife, it is the way people interact with one another, it is their habit. Here we need to establish what do we mean by adalat in a fiqhi sense. To what extent? Do we mean that a person who is adil will not do any sin? Is that what we mean? Or he should not even do any makruh? Or he should do all his wajib? Or he should do all his mustahabbat as well? Every single mustahabbat that he can think of? Does it mean he does not make a simple error? Not a sin. Error? What does it mean? We have definition of the extent of adalat that we expect. Some people, unfortunately, through their own naivety, they expect marjas and scholars to be like our first imam. They want that level of piety. Well, that's not going to happen. Imam himself said, you will not have the strength to be like me, but maintain as much taqwa, firmness, modesty as possible. He himself says it. So what do we expect from a marja or a besh imam with one salawat ala Muhammad wa alayhi? What we expect is that they do not break laws of religion, that they do the wajibat and they don't do haram. This is what we expect. That is basically the fundamental bottom line of adalat. Let me read you two paragraphs from Agha Sistani Sozeewul Masahim. By the way, I would like to mention something which is very important. Every Shia, every Mormon should have five books in their household. Five books. Number one, Holy Quran. Number two, Nahjul Balagha, the words, the letters, the sayings of Imam, our first Imam. Number three, Sahifa Sajjadiyah, the du'as of our fourth Imam. Number four, Mafatihul Jinan, the collection by Sheikh Abbas Qumi of all different prayers, zikrs, ziyarat, du'as, etc. Mafatihul Jinan. Fifth, Tawzihul Masail of your marja. Whichever marja you have chosen, get the latest Tawzihul Masail. There is one being sold outside right now. On the table outside, if you are doing the Taqleed of Agha Sistani, make sure you get that copy. For God's sake, be up to date in your Islamic laws. At least in your daily interactive life, you will know what to follow and what not to follow. Five books must be in every Shia's home. Now, from that book I'm quoting. Ruling number two, regarding a marja. A just person is someone who does the things that are obligatory and refrains from doing the things that are unlawful. The sign of being just is that one appears to be a good person, such that if local people, neighbors, or those who associate with him were to be asked about him, they would confirm his good character. We don't need to pry into people's lives. We don't need to spy on people and see their every movement. Islam doesn't like that. Islam doesn't want that. You take the outer appearance of a person and his general reputation as a sign of adalat. Regarding the Imam of Namaz, Besh Imam, being just means he does the things that are obligatory, refrains from the things that are unlawful. The sign of being just is that he appears to be a good person, as long as one does not have information that contradicts it. Again, you don't get the sense here that we have to spy on people and pry on people. Inshallah, Allah gives us all something called Husn-e-Zan. Husn-e-Zan is what? A good idea about one another. When you meet someone, you meet them with a good idea. That his father, inshallah, is a good person. That is the attitude of Islam. We want to have a Muhammad wa Allah. The third level of justice that I want to discuss today. This is now going very deep. So we've covered concept, we've covered fit, we've covered Mawla's view. Now we are going to discuss the irfani or akhlaqi or spiritual view of justice. Justice applies to everything, including the human soul. The soul of a person is subject to justice. Islam, especially Shia Islam, is a religion of moderation. You see, throughout our hadith, Masumin have always talked about following the middle path, the moderate path. That is why today we don't have, alhamdulillah, the same problems that we see in other versions of Islam. Today, it is shocking to see what some people are calling Islam. Things being done in the name of Islam. Things being done with the slogan of Islam. Things being done and then a hadith put under it. Things being done and then an ayat of Quran being put under it. Thank God we have our imams to guide us and our ulama to guide us away from these extremities. Islam says to achieve justice in the soul, in the spirit of a person, we must look at the three faculties of the soul. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. In every human soul, in every human soul, there are three faculties, or in an easier way of understanding, we can say drivers. What drives our soul? What makes it do certain things? Where does it get its desires? Where does it get its dislikes? Three faculties. Number one, the first faculty is known as Quwwa Ghadabiyya, the faculty of anger. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us the faculty of anger in our soul. What does that mean? That means, for example, when we are under threat, when we are going to be attacked, when we find that we are in danger, our anger kicks in and we defend ourselves. If our honor is being affected, we defend ourselves. If our house is being attacked, we defend it, we fight back, we resist. This is the faculty of anger. There are three positions in the faculty of anger. There is an extreme underusage of anger. If a person underuses his anger, what will it be? He will be a coward. If a person overuses his anger, what will it be? He'll be like a brute, like an aggressive person, a violent person. What will it be if he goes in the middle position? He will be chastened. I beg your pardon. He will be brave. He will be shuja. A shuja person, someone who is brave, knows where to use anger and knows where not to use anger. A brave person doesn't mean he reacts to every situation. Sometimes silence is bravery. For example, they say that a warrior like our first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam, who was so amazingly strong in battle, after the demise of Rasulullah, why did he rise up? He could have taken on the whole of the Ummah single-handedly. All of those corrupt individuals who had taken power, he could defeat them all. We don't understand. Bravery at that moment was to have sabr. Bravery at that moment was not to attack. When Abu Sufyan comes to Imam and says, your right has been taken, this is very bad, I will give you thousands of soldiers, you join forces with me, let's go and kill everybody, Mawla says, no thank you. That's bravery. So, not having sufficient anger is cowardice. Having too much is becoming a brute or a violent person. Having the right moderation is bravery. Now the second. Huwaya Shahwiya, the faculty or the driver of desire. What is the driver of desire? It is when our soul tells us that sometimes we need to eat, sometimes we need to drink, sometimes we need to fulfill our other desires. That is the faculty or the driver of the soul known as the driver of desire. Now we play the same game, the three positions. Someone whose soul is telling him you need to eat, he doesn't eat, what will happen? He will become ill, and eventually he'll die. Yeah? There's an incident just, I don't know if you saw it in the news, a girl somewhere in this country only, 68 days she fasted, unfortunately she passed away from a different faith. So, if you don't obey your desires, you're going to become ill and then die. What if you overindulge? You overindulge in the physical pleasures, the lusts of life, the pleasures of the flesh. You become perverted. You won't know where to draw the line. What if you go in the middle? You don't overindulge, you don't underindulge. You become what we call in Arabic, asif, meaning chaste. Meaning just the right amount of indulgence in these things. You don't overdo it, you don't underdo it. You become chaste. Now we come on to the third with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. The third faculty or driver in the soul is huwaya aqliya, the driver of intellect. How can intellect be used and misused? If you underuse intellect, you become stupid. If you overuse intellect, let's say you start now to question everything. You start to want to have proof about everything, ridiculous amount of proof, ridiculous amount of questions, like over the top, you become a skeptic. You'll see some people are like this. In religion, either some people are very ignorant, they're stupid, they don't apply their reason, so they go astray sometimes, or they're so much overly skeptical that they can't find a conclusion, they can't form a belief. Islam says in the middle is wisdom. You know how much to question, you know how much to apply your reason, and when there is proof, you accept. That is called wisdom. The signs of a wise person are as follows. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So to achieve the middle position in each of these three is adalah of the nafs. Now, wisdom, the signs of a wise person. Number one, he doesn't accept things without reason. Number two, he doesn't reject things without reason. It's a very dangerous situation when people, through whatever external influence, begin to accept or reject things without reason. That should not happen. Islam is a religion of reason, intellect, and wisdom. We must have very strong methods of verifying our faith. For example, again, on the subject of marjaiyat and marjaat, the robust system that exists in generating a fatwa is amazing. This system has been so finely tuned and refined over the centuries that it's really something to marvel at, the stages that people have to go through in coming up with a fatwa. All of the processes used, all of the terms analyzed, all of the intellectual rules applied, and then we receive a fatwa. Thirdly, when there are compelling reasons and sufficient proof, he doesn't look for additional proof. Sometimes we can become so skeptical that no matter, even if Jibreel came and told us something, we won't accept. There were times in which the Holy Prophet showed people miracles in front of them, they said we don't accept. Why? No wisdom. Fourthly, they are motivated by truth. Why people are always motivated by truth. Whatever happens, they want to follow Haq and support Haq. With one salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So to conclude, just this was a very vital element of our faith. We should have justice in our lives, to the people around us, to ourselves, even to non-human beings. We should have justice in the home, in the community, in society. We have justice within faith. We should respect that. We should respect those who have this justice, the scholars of Islam. We have justice in the soul, which we all need to refine and make sure we stick to that middle path. When Imam Hussein entered Karbala, there's a question of truth which the Shaheed of tonight asks his father. When Imam enters the plains of Nainawa, he recites, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. His beloved son Ali Akbar looks at his father and says, Baba, you have recited this sentence of Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Is it not the case that we are on truth? Imam says, indeed it is. Ali Akbar says, in that case I have no worries. This is the sign of a wise person, that he is only concerned about truth. Ali Akbar salams on Ali Akbar. Ali Akbar was who, brothers and sisters? Ali Akbar was that beloved son of Imam Hussein. People used to say, unfortunately, we missed out on seeing Rasulullah, but we have heard that there is a person in Medina that if we see him, people say that he is just like the image of Rasulullah. People will come to Medina to do the ziyarat of Hazrat Ali Akbar. On the day of Ashura, Ali Akbar waits, because the Ashab of Imam Hussein have forbid any of the blood relatives to go out while they were alive. After the Shahadat of the Ashab, according to reliable history, came the Shahadat of Janabe Ali Akbar. They say that when Ali Akbar comes to Imam Hussein and says, Baba, will you give me the permission to go and fight? They say that Hussein did not say yes. He did not say no. Instead, Hussein bowed his head like a father who knows that he is about to lose his son. Ali Akbar and Imam Hussein, they embrace for one last time. Imam Hussein alayhi salam makes a request to his beloved son. He says, Oh Ali Akbar, you can go, you are going, but do me one favor. Baba, what is the favor? Hussein says, Ali Akbar, as you ride away, make sure you keep looking back. Ali Akbar does not understand at that moment. Ali Akbar says, Yes, Baba, I will. Imam says, before you ride out, go and bid farewell to the ladies. They must be waiting for you. They would want to take a last glimpse of the image of Rasulullah. Ali Akbar, when he goes into the Khaymah of Bibi Zainab, they say that such a matam was happening in the Khaymah just for the wida of Ali Akbar, just for the Khuda Hafiz of Ali Akbar. I ask, what would have been the scene when the Janazah of Ali Akbar came back into the same Khaymah? They say that all the ladies would not let him go quickly. They say that Ali Akbar kept on reaching the door of the tent. Every time he reached the door, a hand would hold his shoulder and say, No, not yet, not yet. Spend some more time with us, O Ali Akbar. Finally, some of the Zakirin have recited that at one time, it was not his shoulder that was held. He somehow felt a small hand on his knees. Some small girl had grabbed the knees of Ali Akbar and was saying, Brother, do not leave us. Ali Akbar comes back to Imam. Imam tells him, As you ride, make sure you keep looking back. Ali Akbar begins to ride. As he rides, he hears a strange noise. He hears as if someone's footsteps are behind him. He Karbala. He battled hard. He fought courageously. At one point, he turned his horse. Imam Hussein stood near the camp of Ahlul Bayt. Ali Akbar turns his horse and comes back to Imam. Imam says, "What is it, my son? What is the matter?" Ali Akbar says, "Baba Jan, my dear father, this armor is heavy. The sun is very hot. I am very tired. Father, is there any chance of any amount of moisture or water? If there is anything, I will have it." Imam says, "Ali Akbar, as you know, there is no water. However, whatever moisture I have in my own mouth, you can take that." Ali Akbar looked at the son of Imam. Ali Akbar says, "Baba, you offer me your tongue. Your tongue is even drier than mine." Ali Akbar turns and he rides out into Karbala. He fights courageously. He fights bravely. At one point they say, no one could touch this Hashimi, this amazing warrior, this grandson of Ali. No one could touch him. They resorted to a cowardly method. From a distance, someone threw a spear. The throw was true. The spear hit him with the body of Ali Akbar. Ali Akbar is half on the horse, half on off the horse. They say in Maktal, that they cut Ali Akbar with their swords, piece upon piece. Ali Akbar falls to the ground. Imam is waiting for the call of Ali Akbar. The call is raised. Adrikni Baba, oh my father, come to me. They say two things happen. They say Imam Hussein could not run normally to Ali Akbar. They say the first thing was that Imam, every few steps that Imam would run, he would fall, and then he would fall. He would crawl a little bit. He would stand up again. He would run again, and again he would fall. And then the Rawi says, one thing which we did not understand, one thing which we could not figure out, is that on the day of Ashura, the sun was bright. There was no sand. There was no storm. Still Hussein was shouting, "Aina, Aina, Ali Akbar, Ali Akbar, where are you? Where are you?" And they realized that there was a cloud over the eyes of Imam Hussein. He was so stricken by grief. Allah la 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 Accept this small amount of Al-Adari from us. Oh Allah, help us to achieve justice in our lives. Oh Allah, forgive us our sins. Oh Allah, hasten the remembrance of our false Imam. Oh Allah, give us unity in our community. Oh Allah, give us the respect of our ulama and maraji. Oh Allah, keep our maraji with us. Oh Allah, bless all mu'mineen, all the Al-Adaran of Imam Hussein. Accept their Al-Adari. Oh Allah, whatever injustices are happening throughout the world, bring them to a swift end. All of these injustices are happening in the name of Islam. Oh Allah, these evil regimes, bring them to a swift end. Make justice happen in these lands. The land of Bibi Zainab is in crisis. The land of Imam Hussein, Iraq is in crisis. Oh Allah, protect our brothers and sisters in these lands. Oh Allah, bless our marhumin. Let us remember all marhumin with Al-Fatiha.